אי מימונת הולישני עפר, רבי חמוך אבר גבור גומינו מילת מלך, ממת ומחי ומת מהשואה מנימנת הנחיל מדים ארוחת הענונאי.
בחייה
מתים, לבדישה ונעלת.
Each weekday morning at 6:45, a group of Oriental Jews gather for prayer. These men are to be seen in the streets around where I live. So are the children from Hasidic families going to and from school, the boys tasseled, the young ones with their side locks. On Friday evenings and Saturday mornings, people go about the Sabbath. Once a year, on the first day of the Jewish New Year, I sit with my children in the front garden and watch the Orthodox on their way to the sea, to empty their pockets of crumbs and their souls of sin. One hot summer's day, an elderly woman rested on the brick wall. We talked, and at a particular point, she pulled up her sleeve to let us see the tattoo. We live among those who visibly declare themselves to be different, to be Jews, the objects of anti-Semitism. For a while last year, the evidence of anti-Semitism was also about us, daubed on walls, thrust into letterboxes. And more recently, someone has thrown a petrol bomb through a synagogue window. For anyone who is a Christian, anti-Semitism is a very problematic tradition. Last summer, there was an article in the magazine Australian Society by the French philosopher Jean-François Lyotard. This is what he wrote.
I say that the Jews represent something Europe neither wishes nor can know anything about. Even when they are dead, Europe expunges their memory and refuses them burial in its earth. All this takes place in its unconscious, without the right of speech. And when the thing is perpetrated in the light of day, Europe is struck by the horror and the terror of seeing its own desire.
And according to Lyotard, that unconscious desire was the force behind an event in France of peculiar awfulness.
In Carpentras, on the 9th of May last year, 1990, there was the worst outbreak of anti-Semitic violence in France since the Second World War. 34 tombs were violated in the cemetery at Carpentras, and one body was exhumed and impaled very horribly.
Anne Friedman of the University of Queensland was responsible for the translation and publication in Australian Society of Lyotard's article.
Carpentras is the oldest Jewish community in France, well over 1,000 years old. It's got a very old synagogue, and although it's a small community, it's still very much a focus for French Judaism. And a lot of people go back there to be buried, as if it's a kind of a focus for the community of French Jews. Of course, it's known terrible persecution throughout the centuries, as elsewhere in Europe, but it has had a continuous history. When the news broke, one of the most shocking things to come out at that time was not just what had happened in Carpentras, but that other similar events had occurred in France in recent years. And this fact put anti-Jewish violence back on the intellectual and political agenda. So it was an occasion for reassertion of Jewish identity for many French secular Jews, and it was also the occasion for a very serious examination of conscience in France as a whole.
How did you hear about it? You were in Europe at the time.
Well, I wasn't in France. I think it would have been different if I had been. I was in Denmark, and I saw the news, and I mean saw it, I didn't hear it, because I don't speak Danish. So it was being mediated to me by my friends there, and they were talking about France being one of the most racist countries in Europe. So my first response to it was rather mitigated by a second one. My first one was absolute shock and outrage, as everybody else was. But I was very concerned to say, what rubbish, the whole of Europe is racist in the same way. France is no worse than anywhere else. But I went back to France in June and started to pick up on some of the very specific French responses to that. I got the story of demonstrations, for example, the very important demonstrations that were held from friends who were there and who were in the demonstrations. And of course, one was very much assaulted by stories of the police investigations and their various successes and failures. I met Lyotard in Denmark while I was there, and I got a sense from him of the dimension of the serious discussions as distinct from the news. And the serious discussions, of course, turned it away from that sense of it was a crime and just a very bad crime and who did it, towards an interrogation of the nature of the event and its relation with French history as a whole.
The French political scene has been thrown into something approaching turmoil by evidence of a sudden upsurge of anti-Semitism. On Monday, there was a huge march through the centre of Paris to protest against the desecration a week ago of a Jewish cemetery at Carpentras. President Mitterrand himself joined the demonstration.
As I say, the event took place on the 9th of May. I think that was a Wednesday to Thursday, was the night of the Wednesday to Thursday. And the big demonstration in Paris was on the following, I think, Monday. Huge demonstration, where for the first time in French Republican history, in French history, therefore, a French president joined a public demonstration. Not only he, but the leaders of all the political parties, with, of course, the exception of the National Front. Similar demonstrations were held in most of the major cities in France.
Indeed, I remembered reading about the Archbishop of Paris, Cardinal Lustiger, speaking on television, a Bible held before him. To violate a grave, he said, is an act at once anti-Christian and anti-Jewish, for it denies the hope of resurrection. It's an act of aggressive paganism. It attacks the Christian faith and the Jewish faith at their heart. Cardinal Lustiger was born a Jew, and his mother perished at Auschwitz.
I don't for one moment want to diminish the sincerity of the people who participated in the demonstrations and in the variety of responses after them too. They were very sincere, they were very shocked, they were very active, and this was the first way they could express spontaneously that shock and the refusal of any form of complicity in the events. That was very important. But I do feel, particularly through the press reports of what that march meant, that what was being asserted was French identity, that somehow what was shocking about the violence at Carpentras was that it assaulted the French sense of who the French are. Who the French are, of course, is the revolutionary heritage and the Declaration of the Rights of Man. And that was very seriously attacked, of course, by the events at Carpentras and was therefore very vehemently reasserted by the political and public responses immediately afterwards. I want to say, however, that after that, as the shock was assimilated into discussions, the discussions were altered to much more serious investigations of what was going on, through analyses of racism in general, to analyses of the general moral decadence of the late 20th century, including a number of investigations of relations between Jews and Christians in France, in some of the philosophical and religious writings, and including, but as a very special case, Lyotard's article, which said, this is not racism, this is not just general moral decadence, this is not a crime, a number of things like that. I want to think of it as anti-Semitism, I want to think of anti-Semitism as a fact about Europe, and I want to think of it on a large historical scale. So there's a kind of refusal in Lyotard to think of it in local terms. Local in the sense of what's been happening in the last few years with the National Front. Local in the sense of thinking, well, it's just the last 50 years of European history. Local in the sense of, well, we could do a sociology of it. He refuses those sorts of strategies and he says, Europe is 2,000 years old and anti-Semitism is as old as Europe and is as old as Christian Europe.
And this is part of what Lyotard said.
The Jews are not a nation. They do not speak their language or take root from a piece of nature like the nations of Europe.
Their claim to be the Jews rests on a book. But this mere fact that the Jews are the men of the book doesn't explain the desecration of their cemeteries. What does go somewhere towards explaining it, on the other hand, is what is in their book. Because that is what Europe, first Christian, then Republican, now wealthy and permissive, neither can nor wants to know. That book, the basis of its entire culture, is excluded from that culture at its very heart. It's an old story. It begins with Paul's epistles to the Romans and the Hebrews. Forgive my brevity and its necessary distortions. The book of the Jews says, God is a voice. There is no access to his visible presence. Anything that passes itself off as the divine made visible, idol, charismatic leader, supreme guide, false prophet or son of God, is a fraud. The law of justice and peace takes on no bodily form. It holds up no example to be followed. It gives you a book to read, full of stories to interpret. It does not belong to you, for you to bargain with. You belong to it. Now what Paul says is this. Not at all. The moment Jesus died upon the cross, the veil of the temple was rent once and for all. Once and for all, the apostle repeats. His sacrifice redeemed your sins. The law has spared you. God gave you his Son and the death of his Son as a visible example. Through him, the voice has been shown. Its instruction was clear. Love one another like brothers.
Lyotard's account of the metaphysical difference between Jew and Christian. Out of that account, he is able to go on.
I accuse no one. At stake is a différend confirming the relation with the symbolic, that is, with the law and with death. The Christians announce that, in the end, we are all reconciled as brothers. The Jews remind us that we remain sons, blessed but rebellious. The remission method is nicer to hear and easier to exploit than the memory of unworthiness. But today, following the Shoah, is it not over? It will never end.
And isn't that terrifying?
Yes, I agree. They're very desperate. If you'll permit me, I'd like to read a very short quotation where he's talking about what he thinks the vocation of a philosopher is. Is the only purpose of philosophy the reflective function, to transform, as Kant thought, dispute into litigation by substituting the law court for the battlefield? Or is it not its aim also that of emphasising disputes? That strategy of emphasising and indeed of aggravating, making worse, as it were, dramatising differences and problems is one that he does as a matter of course in whatever problem he approaches. His view is that if we pretend it's not as bad as it is, we won't do anything about it.
Anne Friedman. When Australian Society published Lyotard's article, a provocative piece, it received no response. No one, it seemed, remarked what could be an invitation to pessimism. No one took pen to paper to wonder whether something very ordinary, a simple matter of difference, was being elevated to such extraordinary heights of abstraction that, yes, it would be insurmountable. Nor did anyone ask how useful is a philosophy which diagnoses difference while denying any kind of universality that will allow us to live together, in Australia, in reasonable harmony. And certainly, no one queried Lyotard's theology. Lyotard is one of those French philosophers for whom political events of the last 30 years or so have been radically disillusioning. David Bennett teaches a course on postmodern criticism at Melbourne University.
He was for a long time a militant socialist. During the 50s and early 60s, he was a member of the group called Socialism or Barbarism. He worked for Algerian Liberation, and he played an active role in organising protest at the beginning of the May 68 student uprising. But his work since the 1970s could loosely be associated with a generation of so-called post-Marxist or post-modernist French intellectuals, one-time left-wingers like Michel Foucault, Gilles Deleuze, Jean Baudrillard, for whom that failed revolution of 68 represented a watershed in their thinking about political philosophy and social psychology, and led to a powerful reaction against various communist and Marxist traditions in France, as well as to a profound rethinking of the social vocation of the philosopher. The philosopher is a professor of knowledge, a speaker of universal truths.
All Lyotard's work is a critique of contemporary society, but it's done as a philosopher. He's one of the most topical philosophers working in France at the moment. He does loads of journalism, taking on issues that are occurring all over the place, and at the same time relating them with his deep philosophical concerns and expanding those concerns through what's going on around him. In that, I think he continues a very long and strong tradition of what counts as philosophy in France, starting with people like Voltaire. The philosophes in 18th century France were people for whom engagement with the social and engagement with metaphysics were not separate.
Well, Lyotard talks about the disappearance of the heroic intellectual, and he mentions Voltaire, Zola, Sartre as examples of the heroic intellectual. And this disappearance seems to coincide in Lyotard's account of intellectual history with what he describes as the increasing fragmentation of knowledges in the postmodern world, or what he calls advanced societies, post-industrial technocratic societies. Knowledge fragments into a series of specialisms, specialist techniques and procedures, each with its own criteria of validity, its own discrete language, which is fundamentally incompatible, incommensurable with those of other languages. And he has a very ambivalent attitude to this fragmentation of knowledges in the postmodern world. On the one hand, he has a nightmare vision of a world in which scientific research, knowledge in all fields, is governed solely by what he calls the principle of performativity. In other words, efficiency or productivity for its own sake, higher output from lower input. On the other hand, he's deeply suspicious of the idea of consensus, and the role of the philosopher for him is not to try to bind these disparate knowledges back into some unifying or universal truth. Like a number of other French intellectuals of this post-war generation, people like Foucault, Deleuze, Jacques Derrida, Lyotard has a profound suspicion of what he would call metaphysical thinking, which deals in universals or absolute truths, which he sees as totalitarian and terroristic, his words, in a directly political sense. He speaks of the crimes against humanity which have been perpetrated in the name of various totalizing theories of human history and its goals. He refers to Marxism, to Hegel's philosophy of spirit, to the philosophy of economic and political liberalism, not to mention Nazism. So what concerns him are the exercises and abuses of power which invariably occur when one social group or one culture claims to speak for humanity as a whole and violently imposes its system of thought, its notions of truth, of law, of justice on other groups.
He does a fairly strong attack on notions such as the French people or we humanity, and does a very sustained analysis of the very pronoun we, saying how impossible it is, and that to go on believing that the word we is possible given those differences is a way of pulling the wool over our eyes. And I think starting from there, yes, it does make a difference to how we understand social relations, relations to the law, economic relations, the way we tell our histories, those sorts of questions.
And so to the question of anti-Semitism. God of Israel, in Schoenberg's expression. Inconceivable because unseen, because immeasurable, everlasting,
eternal, ever-present, and omnipotent. The one God is almighty. You'll recall that Lyotard describes the difference between Jew and Christian as one concerning the relation with the symbolic. For example,
a Christian manages to reconcile things. The debt towards the other has been symbolically paid once and for all. Autonomy is allowable within certain limits, which vary from church to church. But for a Jew, the debt is not symbolically discharged. There is only the promise that it will be discharged. Its settlement depends neither on deeds nor even on intentions, but on emancipation by God alone.
And it's this kind of difference which represents what Lyotard calls a différend.
The French word différend translates literally as a dispute, a disagreement, a difference. And in Lyotard's sense of the term, a différend occurs when two parties to a dispute can't articulate their causes in the same idiom. They don't share the same criteria of truth or validity. So a différend can give rise to what Lyotard calls a wrong or an injustice when the claims of an injured party aren't judged according to that party's own criteria of truth or validity. So in effect, the injured party is silenced, disempowered, becomes a victim. So if we can take a hypothetical example of this, in a dispute over land rights, a Koori might claim an injury based on a traditional relationship between her people and a given territory, a relationship which is not one of property ownership. Now, in a European court, which conceives of land as property, this claim is either silenced or it's converted into the alien terms of European capitalist law as a right to property ownership. So in Lyotard's terms, the Koori becomes a victim of a différend because the discourses involved are fundamentally incompatible, incommensurable.
And Australia is alive with different discourses. That's the nature of our heterogeneity, our multiculturalism. Are we doomed then, by Lyotard's analysis, to division and discord? To take up the matter of anti-Semitism, the very first question has to be, how good is Lyotard's theology? Is it adequate, the way he metaphysically characterizes Jew as opposed to Christian? For the difference he describes is the foundation of his account of anti-Semitism. Take his notion that Jews are not a nation.
They do not speak their language or take root from a piece of nature like the nations of Europe. Their claim to be the Jews rests on a book.
Yes, it's an interesting idea, and it took me a long time to think about what he could really mean. I think he's taking into account a certain notion of reading, which is characteristic of that very long tradition of interpretation of the Torah. That tradition of interpretation is a kind of continuous interrogation of the Torah. It's not a search for answers as to what the law means. It's a sort of continuation of the question, what does the law mean?
But where does that leave secular Jews?
I think the only way I can answer that is personally. I don't spend my life studying the law, reading the Talmud. And yet, I was brought up as a Jew, and having been brought up as a Jew, I have a sort of visceral resistance to the story of the risen Christ. I can't do anything about it. It's automatic. It's unreflecting. It's perhaps not even particularly intelligent. I don't know. But I think that's a personal and experiential version of what Lyotard is talking about. That is the Jewishness of the secular Jew.
Anne Friedman, here's another perspective. Pamela Fuchs is a member of the Council of Christians and Jews.
I do not agree with his basing of this difference on the fact that Jews are people of the book. Both Christians and Muslims have for centuries declared that they were also people of the book. He also states that they are people of the book as opposed to people who are a nation. He says they, unlike other peoples in Europe, do not take root from a piece of nature. One assumes that by the book he means the Jewish Bible, the Hebrew Bible. A great deal of it, in fact, deals with their struggle for the land. It deals with the promise made by God that they would be given a land, that they would become a great nation. It then deals with the journey with Moses to actually reach that land and make of themselves a nation. and over the centuries with their struggle to live in the land, to hold on to the land, to extend the boundaries of the land. Now, one of the problems, I think, is that we have spiritualized the concept of Israel to the extent that we no longer have to accept that Israel actually means a piece of land. And because we've done that in terms of the nation of Israel in past ages, it means that we don't have to take seriously the Israel that is there now. He also shows no understanding of the development of that book. The Hebrew Bible, as we know it now, was a fairly late product of centuries of oral stories being written down and then that written form being changed and reworked. And certainly the Jews existed well and truly as a people before the book came into existence. I suppose I would only want to say that the Jews were people of the book insofar as the fact that the book tells the story of the people during their struggles.
Pamela Fuchs. Another member of the Council of Christians and Jews is Paul Forgas, headmaster of Melbourne's Mount Scopus Secondary School.
The other thing I would add in relation to this, of course, is that even after the Jewish people were exiled from their homeland, after the destruction of the Second Temple and the exile by the Romans, there's a sort of a notion that seems to exist that once the physical links of the Jewish people with the land were severed in that way, they no longer effectively were a nation in the usually accepted sense of the word. Now, the fact remains is that for thousands and thousands of years they maintained a yearning to return to the land, expressed in prayers, in all sorts of spiritual activities. Always their state of consciousness was very much directed towards the concept of return to the land of Israel. And they always, I think, saw themselves in a state of exile. And that would only imply, that has to imply, that they always saw themselves in a state of wanting to return to a homeland. Now, I would say that that notion is very much alive in the minds of most Jews today. I mean, for example, I am an Australian, yet in a very significant way, I see myself spiritually and in terms of my consciousness being very much linked to the land of Israel, which I see as the spiritual and national homeland of the Jewish people. Even though I'll never live there, perhaps, it really has nothing to do with it. There are many people in Australia today for whom this is not an uncommon experience. There are Italians, there are Greeks. The multicultural experience of Australia is such that people, whilst living here and seeing themselves as part of the nationhood of Australia, also see themselves as having links to another land as well.
The Christian difference is articulated by the Apostle Paul in, quote, his epistles to the Romans and the Hebrews. The injunction is to love one another like brothers.
That, I think, is very much a reflection of the sort of Christian stereotypes that have operated for centuries. I think really what one has to do as a Christian is to stand outside of themselves and try to understand Judaism in terms of its own self-defining categories. And only then will they begin to understand that the sort of perhaps claims that they make for Christianity in terms of its morality are in fact, at the end of the day, if one looks very closely, grounded in Jewish life and in Jewish theology.
To begin with, one should perhaps state that Paul did not write the letter to the Hebrews. So whilst I think that Lyotard shows a grave lack of understanding of the nature of what it is to be a Jew, I think he also greatly oversimplifies what it is to be Christian, and certainly his understanding of the message of Paul is exceedingly suspect if he thinks that Paul wrote the letter to the Hebrews. It seems to me that he is perpetuating the old myth that Judaism is the religion of the law. Christianity, on the other hand, is the religion of love. Now, a great deal of the Hebrew Bible focuses on the responsibility in love and in obedience to God to actually care for the people with whom you live, especially the weak members of the society in which we live. So we have certainly not created the idea that we should love each other.
What about the claim for Judaism that it's a religion that has nothing to reveal but the impossibility of revelation?
Yes, he starts off, in fact, by stating that the Book of the Jews says God is a voice, there is no access to his visible presence. Now, a great deal of the Bible talks about God actually being present in some visible form. Moses sees God. In fact, there's a nice little bit in the book of Exodus where we're told that Moses and Aaron and a large number of the other elders go up to the mountain and they see God face to face, and they live and they sit down, they eat and they drink with God. We're told that Abraham sees God in the men that arrive to sit and eat with him by the oaks at Mamre. So I do not agree to begin with that the book says that God is not able to be present. He goes on to say that therefore anything that actually passes itself off as revelation of God was in fact to be rejected by the Jews, and that's really not so. I mean, one has to accept that all of the people who first did accept Jesus as somehow sent by God were in fact Jews. And at various stages in Jewish history, others were seen as being sons of God. And over the centuries, there have been other examples of charismatic leaders who have certainly convinced numbers of people that they were the one that everybody had been waiting for.
I'm not one of those who tends to see as the main agenda of dialogue a moving together to sort of somehow believe that we are really at the end all the one people and we're all, you know, in the same bed together. I think the main purpose of dialogue is, yes, to appreciate that there are similarities, but really to understand and accept the ways in which we're different. I mean, I guess coming back to that article, the writer of that article makes a big thing about difference. I would suggest, however, that I don't want to make a big thing about it. I simply want people to understand that there is a difference, what the difference is, and that it's okay to be different, and that we should be accepting of each other's differences as well.
Paul Forgas, and before him Pamela Fuchs, arguing that the differences between them are not open to the kind of radical interpretation required by Lyotard's thesis. For all the events of the last 2,000 years, there is a momentum towards dialogue. Ever since the Second Vatican Council called for mutual understanding and respect, that dialogue between Christian and Jew, backed by biblical scholarship, has been intense. Frank Maloney is a highly regarded biblical scholar and a Catholic priest. He speaks of that dialogue taking place in a post-Holocaust era.
I think a great amount has already been done by both Christian and Jewish scholars to re-establish the essential Jewishness of the Christian movement. That its roots come out of the Jewish world, that the founder of Christianity is a Jew, and that the earliest experience of the Christian life was lived within Judaism. Now, this is largely my area. I'm interested in that, the origins. And I am increasingly impressed by the fine work done by both Jewish and Christian scholars in this area. But my reference to the Holocaust is an indication that that really is not where the problem lies. The problem lies in the traditions, both of Christianity and of post-Christian Judaism. Judaism took a very important and essential new line after the destruction and the fall of Jerusalem from 70 onwards, with the re-establishment of the synagogue and a basically Pharisaic, law and synagogue-oriented Judaism from then on. Now, it's had a multiplicity of variations upon those themes, but they have developed their own tradition, and a rich and wonderful tradition it is. Christianity has also developed its own tradition, and that's where the problem lies. Never the two shall meet. There simply has not been sufficient dialogue over the 2,000 years of the coexistence of what a wonderful book is called Rebecca's Children. And in fact, not only has there not been dialogue, there has been anger and violence and murder and all sorts of things. Now, the problem lies in a profound dialogue, not over the Jewish origins. That's clear. I think we've established that. But where we have gone since then, and that is a long and painstaking task, where the guilt of the past has to be admitted without becoming paranoid about it all. And I think this is also a great challenge to the Jewish side of the debate, not to force the Christian villains into a paranoia.
And given that past, what are the prospects for reconciliation?
The problem will not eventually be the memory of the terrible things that were done. I think the problem in some ways, linking up with what I was saying in answer to your earlier question, will be what our two traditions have made of Jesus. For a real unity between Judaism and Christianity, there's going to have to be a remarkable shift in position from the Christian tradition, with some of its exalted claims about Jesus, and a shift in the Jewish position in some of its attempts to perhaps make Jesus just another good Jew. I would see this as a very difficult debate, but somehow or other there must be a radical shift in the understanding of the person of Jesus of Nazareth from both sides, and that is where the dialogue is going on. It's got to be recognised that the dialogue is going on.
Father Frank Maloney. When I spoke with David Bennett, I asked him what sort of critique could be made of Lyotard's philosophy of difference.
Well, his insistence on radical difference, the need to tolerate it, to respect it, suggests that there is nowhere in between totalitarianism and anarchy. Totalitarianism, in his terms, would be the imposition by one group, one culture on another, of its truths as universal human truths, as absolutes. So as I say, for Lyotard, there seems nowhere between the totalitarianism of universals and anarchy. In other words, he seems to envisage no political program, no collective political program, which would be a realization of this notion of tolerance. There is, though, I think, a contradiction in Lyotard's, or at least an irony, in Lyotard's absolute intolerance of absolutes, for which he's been picked up by the American pragmatist philosopher Richard Rorty, who also points out that there are forms of persuasion, possibilities of persuasion, which don't necessarily rely on violence or coercion. One group can be persuaded to adopt another's way of thinking about identity or value without the use of violence. And in fact, the use of violence often produces exactly the opposite effect. So there are ways in which, from the liberal tradition, or at least the pragmatist tradition, Lyotard's work can be criticized.
The very fact of dialogue between Jews and Christians is an implicit criticism, as is dialogue between Buddhists and Christians, or Christians and Muslims. For at its highest level, dialogue is about going beyond dialogue to reflect collaboratively on the meaning of human history. A Christian theologian like Jürgen Moltmann talks about the genesis of a universal community where the plurality of religions remains, but in which all people are liberated, infected as it were with the spirit of hope, love and responsibility. The politics and social change of our times mean that religions are obliged to find ways of talking with and about each other.
A few years ago, I asked a Jewish friend of mine why he believed we as Christians and Jews should in fact talk to each other. I could understand why I wanted to talk to him, but I didn't understand after the Shoah why he used to talk to me. He said that he felt that we were both becoming minority groups in an increasingly secular world, and that we needed to stand side by side as witnesses to the one transcendent God. There continue to be places in which, for Christian and Jew, this relationship with the transcendent God has to be the most important thing that rules our lives.
As for the power of Lyotard's thesis for me as an Australian secular Jew, it helped me to define, in terms that are not emotional or sentimental or nostalgic, exactly that sense of where I am a Jew and why I can never cease to be a Jew. There's a difficulty in Australian discussions of these matters because there's a certain habit in Australian debates that says philosophical analysis doesn't help at all. We want sociology, we want on the ground, we want the experiential, what people actually do. I'm concerned that the dismissal of what could be called airy French ideas or philosophy, as if it had no connection with the real world, just because it works at a different level. I'm concerned that if we really go ahead with that dismissal, we'll lose an understanding that can be brought to us. It's not a question of either or, it's a question of the different jobs that sociology and that philosophy can do.
Anne Friedman. If you would like to test the power of Lyotard's thesis for yourself, look in your local library for the December 1990 edition of Australian Society. My thanks to David Bennett, Paul Forgas, Pamela Fuchs, Frank Maloney, and to Anne Friedman. Technical production was by Neil Hobbs. I'm Margaret Coffey. Hey, hey, hey.